The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Flypod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have the author Edward McClelland. He's got a brand new book, Nothing But Blue Skies. This is about the heyday, the hard times, the hopes of America's industrial heartland. We're talking Michigan, mainly Detroit.
Yeah, well, Ohio too.
Yeah.
Mainly Cleveland.
Cleveland, yes. Of course, because you talk a little bit about the river catching on fire.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Edward, welcome. Nothing But Blue Skies, the title, it sounds like it could almost be a song.
Well, I actually got the idea from a fella in South Chicago, which is a neighborhood in Chicago where the steel mills were. And the steel mills in Chicago closed down in the early 80s. And there used to be a saying in that neighborhood and probably in a lot of other industrial neighborhoods, if there's soot on the windowsills, there's food on the table. And he said he looked up one day and he saw a blue sky and he thought it was the end of the world because the steel mills just stained the sky. They created their own cloud cover, their own atmosphere. And so to him, the world had changed.
Edward, what I liked about Nothing But Blue Skies right in the beginning, here you are at school and you're right across from the General Motors plant.
Right.
What was that like?
Well, I mean, I guess if I get lung cancer, I'll know where it came from. I mean, we would run on the track and we would inhale the smell of paint drifting across the street from the factory. I think one of the teachers whose window opened there ended up developing a heart problem. So the school was really just completely integrated into the industrial life of Michigan, even to the point where it was almost part of the production line, that the workers were educated there. There used to be a saying that you could have a diploma in your hand one day and then a ratchet in your hand a week later. You just walk across the street. And when I was starting in school, this was in 1982. This was when the real... You know, the term Rust Belt started coming into use, and when Michigan's unemployment rate was 14%, one of my chemistry teachers started off his class by telling us it used to be that you didn't have to study. You could just walk across the street and get a job in that plant. But those days were over. You guys are going to have to study hard and go to college.
Edward, you talked about, you know, running the track and smelling those paint fumes. Mm-hmm. Is that a real concern of yours? I mean, health-wise?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it was only for a few years. I mean, it wasn't like I was inhaling it every day for 25 or 30 years. I mean, I haven't heard anybody else who went to Sexton who had health problems as a result of that. But it was definitely, you know, as I said, General Motors owned the earth and they owned the sky and they owned the air.
And just like probably other companies throughout the United States.
Right, yeah.
I mean, you mentioned Chicago.
Right.
I can think of Pittsburgh with the steel mills.
Sure. I wrote a chapter about the steel mill in Homestead, Pennsylvania.
Did you ever go through there like as a child when the steel mills were up and running?
No. I mean, we didn't really have steel mills in Michigan. We had auto plants. You know, I've been through auto plants. I never went through. As a child, I used to, you know, sort of look up through the windows when I was in school, and you could see, you know, the line moving. But I never actually got to go in there.
I remember being young and going through Pittsburgh, and mm-hmm. the air was just so thick you could cut it. I mean, anymore,
yeah,
the air is clean, such as any city. I'm sure even Chicago, one of
right.
the largest cities in the United States. I'm sure it was so.
Chicago is, but Gary isn't. Gary still has its steel mill, and when the wind blows off the lake, it just blows smoke right through the middle of downtown Gary.
So, why a book about the industrial, more or less, revolution in the
yeah.
United States?
Well, I guess you remember, like, maybe the industrial counter-revolution. I wanted to answer the question, what happened to all these factories? You know, because in 2006, they started to tear down the Fisher Body plant in Lansing, and there was a sign on the fence that said, "Demolition means progress," and I thought that was kind of Orwellian. And so I wanted to see whether there was any progress. and what was happening into these industrial towns that had, were losing their factories or had lost their factories. And I kind of also wanted to, as someone who's a member of Generation X, I remember when I was first coming into the labor force, I heard stories from baby boomers about how easy it had been for them to get a job. I remember a story about someone in Flint who was just pumping gas, and a personnel officer from General Motors showed up one day and he said, "Why aren't you working in the shop?" which is what they call the auto plants in Michigan. And he just kind of shrugged. So the guy took down his number, and a week later they gave him a call and put him to work on the line. I mean, it was literally that easy. One of the guys I profile in here, his job search consisted of skipping school one day when he was a senior and applying at all four auto plants in Lansing, and he ended up working there 37 years. So for me, that was kind of employment born. It's just not that easy anymore. If you go look back in the late 60s, for a 48-month period, the unemployment rate was never higher than 4%. And just that's just unimaginable today.
So what happened is that mainly the internet things are, I mean, you've got the robots, people just aren't.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. I mean, certainly technology makes it a lot easier. I went to a plant in Lansing where they have that what they call the marriage line, and they actually use satellite technology to so that the bottom of the car meets the top of the car, and they put it together, and they have a woman, they had a pregnant woman with an electric wrench, and she was bolting it together. And they used to have these, you know, teams of guys, you know, with wrenches, and they'd say by the time they retired, their shoulder muscles were gone. So everything's a lot more automated now, certainly. I mean, they make the same number of cars with 5,000 workers in Lansing than they used to make with 25,000.
Do you ever look ahead? I mean, right now the stock market isn't doing too bad. We had probably, what, in the 80s, it really took a sharp turn.
Yeah.
Maybe 90s. It's taken a sharp turn several times, of course, throughout history. But have you really looked at maybe what is going to happen to the economy? I mean, look at Detroit, Michigan, how
right.
they've lost a lot of their jobs. People
right.
just aren't getting jobs like maybe what you talk about in Nothing But the Nothing But Blue Skies, where
yeah.
you could get out of school,
right.
get a job. That's not happening now.
No, no. Well, you talk about Detroit, and I spent a lot of time in Detroit, and it's really, I remember being in Detroit, and I was with some people from Ireland who were there for Movement, the electronic music festival, and they went out and they went on a tour of some of the abandoned plants in Detroit. I mean, those are the big tourist attractions there now, the old Packard plant and the Michigan Central Station. And I think they were so fascinated because that's something that couldn't happen in Europe, in their countries, in their cities. They just don't allow cities to fail like we do here in the United States. And you, I mean, you talk about the future of the economy. One of the things I wrote about in Cleveland was really kind of ground zero for the housing crisis, which ended up sinking the whole economy in 2008. I mean, I even traced it to a particular neighborhood called Slavic Village, where there was a lot of depopulation, a lot of older white ethnic people dying, and their kids who moved to the suburbs didn't want the house. So they put it on the market, and there was a lot of speculation. You know, and this applies statewide because Ohio had some of the weakest banking laws in the nation in the probably early 2000s. And even when Cuyahoga County tried to pass stronger banking laws, they were invalidated by the state legislature. They said, well, no, you can't pass a local banking law that supersedes the statewide banking law. And so there were firms such as Countrywide and Argent, they were coming in and they were pioneering what they called the stated income loan, where if you said you earned $100,000 a year, they took your word for it, and they wrote you a loan. The mortgage lending agents got more money, a higher commission if they wrote an adjustable rate mortgage. And so they were going all over Cleveland, and they were going to the houses of people who may have maybe they had lost their jobs in an industrial concern, saying, well, look, you still have a source of wealth. You can take out another mortgage on your house, and you can still have nice things and live the good life. Or they would even point at you know, the roof was falling down or the porch was sagging, and they'd say, well, you know, that you may get a written up by the city for that. You need to take out a home improvement loan and take care of that. So really, the number of foreclosures in Cuyahoga County ended up tripling. think between 2000 and 2006, and there was a zip code in Cleveland that had a higher percentage of houses in foreclosure than anywhere else in the United States. And of course, that spread throughout the entire country. So one of the points I do like to make in the book is that the nation's cultural and intellectual trends may start on the East and the West Coast, but its economic trends start here in the Midwest. And this is where Henry Ford started paying his workers $5 an hour so they could buy the cars they were making. And this is where the Flint sit-down strike, which I write about in here. I have an interview with a family friend who's 98 years old and was a Flint sit-down striker. That led to the formation of the UAW, which was an important moment in the modern union movement. And of course, as we saw in Cleveland, this is also becoming the graveyard of the middle class.
So what was it like going back to that era, talking to a 95-year-old guy that actually witnessed that, probably one of the few living people yet that participated.
Well, what was just amazing was the bell curve or the ups and downs he'd seen in his lifetime. I mean, he was born on a farm in northern Michigan, and he ended up working at General Motors in Flint and then in Lansing, and he was there in Flint when Flint had one of the highest per capita incomes in the United States. And now Flint has one of the lowest. I mean, the average house in Flint sells for about $18,000, and it's got the highest murder rate in the country. I mean, if New York's murder rate were the same as Flint's, it would have 5,000 murders a year. So it's just amazing that the rise and fall of the middle class just in his lifetime. And one of the questions I ask in the book was the middle class just a moment in history? I mean, we grew up thinking that the American way of life would always expand and there'd always be more and the next generation would always do better. But I think we're finding that that's no longer happening.
Probably going to be just two classes.
Exactly, yeah. And someone I interviewed in the book says you can't have a middle class without a manufacturing base. So that's the importance of maintaining or recovering our manufacturing base.
Edward, you also wrote a book, number four, I guess, of the books that you've written.
Yeah.
Wrote one about the president.
Sure, and there's actually a connection between these two books. As I point out in here, Obama came to Chicago to work in a church-based community organizing group, social service agency, that was founded in response to the closings of the steel mills there, of Wisconsin Steel and U.S. Steel. It was originally called the Calumet Community Religious Conference, and then they spun off an inner-city chapter, and they needed an African-American organizer because that's the community they were working with. And the head of the CCRC put an ad in a magazine called Community Jobs, and Obama had just quit his job in New York City and was trying to get into community organizing. He read it and applied and was hired and came to Chicago, and he worked retraining laid-off steelworkers. They had a $500,000 grant to retrain and re-educate laid-off steelworkers. And young Mr. Obama, that was the previous book I wrote, and that made the point that if he hadn't come to Chicago, he never would have become president of the United States, because there's no other place where African Americans have achieved the kind of political advancement that they have in Chicago. So, but you can really sort of trace his rise to the demise of the steel mills and the Rust Belt era here in the Midwest.
Now, he almost didn't make president. Didn't he have some problems with the Senate there?
Well,
he
had problems when he ran for Congress.
Congress.
Yeah, he ran for Congress in 2000, and that's when I first met him. But part of it was he was running in the wrong race. He was running in the first congressional district, which is a historically black district on the south side of Chicago. And he's not really meant to be the representative of one particular race. He's meant to be a bridge between the races, someone who reconciles the two races. His opponent, who's still in Congress, named Bobby Rush, he really set out to portray him as, not black enough, not a real member of the African American community, and he really gave him a hiding, and it took Obama a few years to recover from that. But I thought he definitely made the right call when he decided to run for the Senate, because he was somebody who was he was going to be acceptable to the South Side, because they were going to think, well, he's black enough to be the senator for the whole state, and suburbanites were comfortable with him because he grew up in a white family. So he just had to find the right way to the presidency. And if he'd gotten elected to Congress, I'm sure he wouldn't be president today.
Did you interview him at all for the book?
Yeah, I did. I mean, and at that time, he wasn't a very good candidate. He wasn't a very good speaker. He was sort of stiff, and he was professorial, and he was kind of pompous. You know, he was a law professor at the time, and he had not learned the difference between giving a law lecture and giving a campaign speech. I remember when I interviewed him, people were saying, well, he's arrogant. And I asked him why he was the best person to represent the South Side when he was not from there. And he kind of stumbled over the answer and said, well, I really have to want to be here. You know, I went to Harvard Law School. I was editor of the Harvard Law Review, and someone who did that, you know, they have their pick of any job on Wall Street, but you know, here I am on the South Side, so I must really be committed. And that's not really the right thing to say. You know, I could be doing something better, but here I am with you people.
So did you give him some pointers to kind of loosen him up? Are you responsible for becoming president?
Somebody said that the article I wrote, which was for a newspaper called the Chicago Reader, really, you know, kind of stung him and was part of him deciding he, you know, had to make a change. Because one thing he definitely did was when he went back down to Springfield, when he was first down in Springfield, he kind of acted like he was above the political process and above the dirty work of trying to get a bill passed. And he went back down there, and he became much more collegial. And you know, he didn't keep pointing out that he'd gone to Harvard all the time. And somebody who makes his living just covering the state legislature said he really turned it around in the few years after he ran for Congress. But he needed to be humbled. He'd been a runaway success his entire life up till then. You know, he'd gotten into Harvard, and he'd gotten a contract to write a book, and he'd gotten elected to the legislature on his first try. So I think that defeat led to later victories.
So knowing the president like you do, mm-hmm. I mean, you've met him, you've interviewed him. What do you figure his biggest challenge is as president?
Well, I think his biggest challenge was, certainly when he came in, was the economy. And I think his background in Chicago and what brought him to Chicago had a big impact on how he dealt with that, specifically the bailout of the auto industry. I mean, I think he understood the importance of manufacturing, having been dropped into a community where it had suddenly disappeared. And certainly Mitt Romney had written that editorial in 2008 that said, let Detroit go bankrupt. I mean, Obama really hit him hard on that. And
now let's talk about the very first book that you ever wrote.
Okay.
What was the name of that one?
That was called Horse Players, Life at the Track. And that was about guys who bet on horses. I guess it was my, very different from these two books. I spent a year at the racetrack going every day. And it was, I guess you could call it my attempt to learn how to beat the races and all the odd characters I met along the way.
Can you?
You can, but you have to go every day. You can win money at the track, but you can't win enough to make it worth all the effort it takes. Maybe if you have $1 million bankroll, but I didn't have that much money. I could usually grind out about a 7% profit, which is not bad, but I mean, just to make $35,000 a year, you'd have to bet $500,000. Once I started betting that kind of money, I just lost my composure. So, and now it's something I just do rarely, because I learned that you have to be totally committed if you want to expect to win. So I go now and I don't expect to win.
You know, I know that horses have their own personalities. You mm-hmm. can tell by their trot, if you will, when they're trotting them around, their ears, whether they're paying attention and everything. Mm-hmm. Is that the best way maybe to bet a horse, is looking at the horse?
Well, I think it's to watch their races and take notes on them and see how they're running and see if they got into trouble in their last race and if they got blocked by another horse or if they were on the wrong part of the track. So that's part of it. I mean, if you see a horse who looks really bad, if you see a horse that's head down and it's sweating, you want to throw that horse out for sure.
It's too bad you can't bet on like a put like you would an option. You could bet.
Can short a horse.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, you can do that on. I think there are websites where you can do that, or you could do that before internet gambling was banned for Americans. But there are probably still ways to get around that. But yeah, there are. Websites where they sort of sell, like you said, options on horses, so you can short a horse.
That'd be funny.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, well, hopefully, you know, my feeling is that it's America. You make your own money. You
yeah,
should spend it the way that you want. Hopefully, one day they'll open that up.
Well, I have an offshore opinion. Wagering account in Costa Rica. So
it's funding but a lot of great things.
I was able to deposit my money in there, but there are a lot of the, if you look on the British websites, they have a drop-down menu. What country you're from? They have every country in the world except the United States. You can bet on horses on the internet, but you can't bet on sports or politics or anything like that.
Yeah, the fun things.
Exactly.
Nothing But Blue Skies, this brand new book. What was the biggest challenge with writing this book?
The biggest challenge with writing it? I guess probably weaving the historical context into the modern day stories. I mean, I guess some people have criticized it for not being enough of a history, but I really didn't want to just write a straight history because I'd read a lot of books like that and a lot of books that talked about the economic causes of this. And I wanted to really tell the stories of the people who lived through it and how it affected them. And I wanted to give people a feeling of what it was like to live in an industrial community. And so I sort of tried to weave in the history among the personal stories. So I guess if you're just looking for a straight, you know, history book, then maybe this isn't it. But then, you know, when people said that, it would kind of bother me a little bit because it was sort of like saying, well, you're only writing history if you write about a CEO or a senator, not about the people who are actually affected by history or their decisions. I mean, the CEOs and senators, they got through this fine. But this was about people who had some struggles as a result of these factories closing.
So when I pick up Nothing But Blue Skies, what am I going to get out of this book? What do you expect the reader to get out of the reading?
What do I expect the reader to get out of the reading? I guess to learn about a period when the middle class was stronger than it's been at any time in American history, and to learn about the consequences of the disappearance of the middle class, and to learn about what cities like Cleveland, like Detroit, like Flint are trying to do to reinvent themselves after industry leaves, and also to find out about the importance of some manufacturing to our economy and to the middle class. I mean, hopefully it's a biography of the middle class in America.
Edward, how is the book laid out?
Well, I guess you could say it's laid out like a travelogue. I mean, it's sort of every chapter tells the story of a different city. I think I start in Lansing, and then I'm in Flint talking about the sit-down strike. Then I'm in Buffalo and Detroit, Cleveland, and I go to Decatur, Illinois, where I was a newspaper reporter in the mid-90s, and there was all kinds of labor strife as a result of a strike at the A.E. Staley Manufacturing Company, which makes corn syrup and soy products. So we go from city to city, and then at the end I come back to Lansing, and I revisit Auto Workers Bar I visited in the prologue. It's called Gus's Bar. It was built, it was founded by a Greek immigrant named Gus Kaliakatsos, and he came to America in 1960. He asked the consul, where are the most jobs? And he said, Michigan. So he ended up opening a tavern across the street from the Fisher Body Plant. When it was going, business was big. I mean, he said guys would just come in after the shift change, and whoever shoved his money farthest across the bar, he got served first. But then as soon as the plant closed, he had to lay off 14 of his barmaids, and he was pretty much doing it all himself when I saw him, and he hadn't been able to sell the bar. And so I went back to see him, and he said he'd finally sold the bar. And then after the book came out, I went to see him again, and I showed him the book, and he said, oh, that looks great, but I can't read English. He can only read Greek.
Hopefully it'll come out in the Greek language.
Yeah, but you know, the bar is still struggling along. It's still around, amazingly enough.
Edward, if I want to find out more about Nothing But Blue Skies or the three other books that you have, I'm sure you have a website.
Yeah, it was just my name, edwardmcclellan.com, E-D-W-A-R-D. mcclellan.com. You can read the prologue of the book.
Nothing But Blue Skies, the brand new book by Edward McClelland. I tell you what, this will take you back in time to a time where you could just get out of high school with that diploma and walk right into a job. You just can't do that anymore. A real thought-provoking book. Brings you right back into present day time. Nothing But Blue Skies by Edward McClellan. Edward, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Edward McClelland, author of his brand new book, Nothing But Blue Skies. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.